Well, good evening.
Good evening.
Tonight we take up the 24th chapter in the Life Divine. And this was the closing chapter for the second year of the Arya. The knot of matter, which is the 25th chapter, would begin the third year. This citation from the Taittiriya Upanishad is familiar to us from the old parable that we've read in the study we've made of the Upanishads long back. It is the discovery of the disciple following the empowerment that the guru gives to achieve a penetration into what is the true nature of Brahman. Now, you remember that he goes on and discovers greater realm after greater realm, but his first discovery is that matter is Brahman. So here we have it. He arrived at the knowledge that matter is Brahman. Anam Brahmeti. The Taittiriya Upanishad, by the way, is one of the older Upanishads, ranking only behind Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya. This one was probably composed in the Kuru Panchala area of India, a strong bastion of the Aryan civilization. And we will meet several themes in this chapter echoing this strong asseverance that the divine purpose to be complete must fulfill itself in matter. Yes to life. Yes to material world. Not no. So, chapter 24 then, matter. We have now the rational assurance that life is neither an inexplicable dream nor an impossible evil that has yet become a dolorous fact, but a mighty pulsation of the divine all existence. This is his earliest formulation, isn't it? As he begins to describe to us the ontology of the world, the nature of the being of the world, that it arises from that which transcends all possible definition. Even that which we say positively about it is insufficient. But if we want to ascribe some way of mental formulation that conveys what that reality is, we can say that it is. We can say that it is conscious of its own existence and that the nature of its consciousness is delight. And so we begin from this, and all existence is a figuration of that Satchit-Anand. We see something of its foundation and its principle. We look upward to its high potentiality and ultimate divine outflowering. But there is one principle below all the others which we have not yet sufficiently considered. The principle of matter upon which life stands as upon a pedestal, or out of which it evolves like the form of a many-branching tree out of its encasing seed. The mind, life, and body of man depend upon this physical principle, and if the outflowering of life is the result of consciousness emerging into mind, expanding, elevating itself in search of its own truth and the largeness of the supramental existence, yet it seems also to be conditioned by this case of body and by this foundation of matter. So our whole regular existence then depends upon the physical. And if consciousness evolves towards this sublime height, yet we must acknowledge that the emergence of this consciousness is conditioned by its encasement and emergence from this physicality. What is matter, by the way, is not agreed upon throughout the epochs of human thought. Every philosopher has a different idea about what matter is. The ancient Greeks, who called it hyle, H-Y-L-E, had their own perspective, which was overturned by later philosophy. The perspectives of the Middle Ages differ from those of the modern age, so we begin with the presumption that we know what matter is, that it's extensible, that it's measurable, that it fills form. But that was not necessarily always the view. Sri Aurobindo, setting aside all this philosophic disputation, is deriving the principle of matter from its ontological precedence, from this great chain of being, in much the way that Plotinus begins with his vision of the supreme and then sees matter at the bottom of a gigantic hierarchy of being. But for Sri Aurobindo, it isn't that matter is darkness and evil, but as you shall see, it is filled with the resplendence of Satchidananda. So, the importance of the body is obvious. It is because he has developed or been given a body and brain capable of receiving and serving a progressive mental illumination that man has risen above the animal. Equally, it can only be by developing a body, or at least a functioning of the physical instrument capable of receiving and serving a still higher illumination, that he will rise above himself and realize, not merely in thought and in his internal being, but in life, a perfectly divine manhood. So the physical instrument must be radically improved to support a divine life. If this is the aim, then much has to be done. Otherwise, either the promise of life is canceled, its meaning annulled, and earthly being can only realize Satchidananda by abolishing itself, by shedding from it mind, life, and body, and returning to the pure infinite, or else man is not the divine instrument. There is a destined limit to the consciously progressive power which distinguishes him from all other terrestrial existences, and as he has replaced them in the front of things, so another must eventually replace him and assume his heritage. So if we cannot address successfully this puzzle about our physical nature and make it the fitting instrument and garb for the emerging Satchidananda, then we would have two options. Either the spirit within, disgusted at this imperfection, this inability, would withdraw to heavens above, too frequently seen in the annals of spirituality. Or we would be replaced. Either we quit the universe or surrender to a replacing race who would supplant the human species with something bolder, more capable, wiser, more compassionate. Can we ourselves grow into that is the challenge. It seems indeed that the body is from the beginning the soul's great difficulty, its continual stumbling block and rock of offense. Therefore, the eager seeker of spiritual fulfillment has hurled his ban against the body, and his world disgust selects this world principle above all other things as an especial object of loathing. The body is the obscure burden that he cannot bear. Its obstinate material grossness is the obsession that drives him for deliverance to the life of the ascetic. To get rid of it, he has even gone so far as to deny its existence in the reality of the material universe. Most of the religions have put their curse upon matter and have made the refusal or the resigned temporary endurance of the physical life the test of religious truth and of spirituality. So the body is seen widely as a block or a snare. It's an impediment to an emerging and growing consciousness. And this is perhaps true of all the ascetic traditions, whether they're Western or Eastern in origination. We have seen that philosophies have developed, which in the persons of the idealists or the monists would deny the very reality of the physical world. And now he comes back to say, the older creeds, more patient, more broodingly profound, not touched with the torture and the feverish impatience of the soul under the burden of the Iron Age, did not make this formidable division. They acknowledged earth the mother and heaven the father, and accorded to them an equal love and reverence. But their ancient mysteries are obscure and unfathomable to our gaze, who, whether our view of things be materialistic or spiritual, are alike content to cut the Gordian knot of the problem of existence with one decisive blow, and to accept an escape into an eternal bliss, or an end in an eternal annihilation or an eternal quietude. So, there is a tradition which is not simply to outlast the body and rise to a spiritual truth. And though it is not specified here, he calls our attention to really the age of the Veda. Prior to the emergence of the Iron Age, he says, where earth the mother, Prithvi, and heaven the father, Dhyanos, have this balance between acceptance and love, valuation of the earth, it is rich, and we are tall in our stature. We stretch from the earth to heaven. We unite the two and bring into harmony all the possibilities of existence. So that is an age which is past. Perhaps we will climb back to that again. It may be lost to us now, but Sri Aurobindo asserts that this unification of spirit and matter is part of an integrated life, is a fitting answer to the omnipresent reality of Satchit Ananda. We cannot live poles apart with our body here and our spiritual awareness there. We cannot entrance ourselves and forget the body, nor can we encase ourselves in the body and ignore our spiritual breadth and height. All must be brought to point here in this material form. So to resume, the quarrel does not really commence with our awakening to our spiritual possibilities. It begins from the appearance of life itself and its struggle to establish its activities and its permanent aggregations of living form against the force of inertia, against the force of inconscience, against the force of atomic disaggregation, which are, in the material principle, the knot of the great denial. So it is this loss of power, loss of our awareness, loss of our unity. In other words, we've lost what we were in Satchit Ananda in coming into this material form. we must recover it. We must do it through the principle of life. He says, then, life is at constant war with matter, and the battle seems always to end in the apparent defeat of life, and in that collapse downward to the material principle we call death. So disintegration, not integration, seems to be what always we encounter in this struggle. Life is at war with matter, and it might be as well here as later to remind ourselves that Sri Aurobindo is writing in the midst of the brutality of the Great War when he first composes this essay on matter. When he revises the essay preparatory to its publication as a book, the world is enmeshed in an even worse war. World War II, World War I. So this aspect of life as a battle is part of the picture of the world. It's part of the way life has been forced to proceed, moving from division back to unity, and how mind grows in it. And let us skip now to that. The discord deepens with the appearance of mind, for mind has its own quarrel with both life and matter. It is at constant war with their limitations, in constant subjection to and revolt against the grossness and inertia of the one and the passions and sufferings of the other. And the battle seems to turn eventually, though not very surely, towards a partial and costly victory for the mind, in which it conquers, represses, or even slays the vital cravings, impairs the physical force, and disturbs the balance of the body in the interests of a greater mental activity and a higher moral being. It is in this struggle that the impatience of life, the disgust of the body, and the recoil from both towards a pure mental and moral existence take their rise. When man awakens to an existence beyond mind, he carries yet farther this principle of discord. Mind, body, and life are condemned as the trinity of the world, the flesh and the devil. Mind, too, is banned as the source of all our malady. War is declared between the spirit and its instruments, and the victory of the spiritual inhabitant is sought for in an evasion from its narrow residence, a rejection of mind, life, and body, and a withdrawal into its own infinitudes. The world is a discord, and we shall best solve its perplexities by carrying the principle of discord itself to its extreme possibility, a cutting away and a final severance. So the higher powers in us aspire to a kind of freedom and purity. We see in this that the mind as well as the life and the body are regarded as instruments of the nature and therefore subject to rejection. We go all the way back to the original insight of Kapila the sage that all this is not us primarily. We are simply that consciousness abstracted from all of this, even mind with its greatest and most limpid thoughts is simply an aspect of nature, let alone our vitality and our physicality. All of this ought to be rejected. We will cut away and finally sever ourselves from it. That is the solution offered by much of the world's spirituality. Sri Aurobindo has bravely asserted a different and a more positive embrace of matter from the standpoint of a conquering spirit. But these defeats and victories are only apparent. this solution is not a solution, but an escape from the problem. Life is not really defeated by matter. It makes a compromise by using death for the continuance of life. Mind is not really victorious over life and matter, but has only achieved an imperfect development of some of its potentialities at the cost of others, which are bound up with the unrealized or rejected possibilities of its better use of life and body. The individual soul has not conquered the lower triplicity, but only rejected their claim upon it and fled from the work which spirit had undertaken when it first cast itself into form of universe. So these defeats and victories of life, which is not really defeated by matter, it has made a compromise to be able to keep going along and plugging along in the universe. Mind may wrestle with and gain a compromise mastery of life and matter, but it is not a sure victory. The soul has not been able to conquer this triplicity, and yet a cosmic purpose remains unfulfilled if our only solution is to pull out. The problem continues because the labor of the divine in the universe continues, but without any satisfying solution of the problem or any victorious accomplishment of the labor. Therefore, since our standpoint is that Satchit Ananda is the beginning and the middle and the end, and that struggle and discord cannot be eternal and fundamental principles in his being, but by their very existence imply labor towards a perfect solution and a complete victory, we must seek that solution in a real victory of life over matter, through the free and perfect use of body by life, and a real victory of mind over life and matter, through a free and perfect use of life force and form by mind, and in a real victory of spirit over the triplicity, through a free and perfect occupation of mind, life, and body by conscious spirit. In the view we have worked out, this last conquest can alone make the others really possible. To the end, then, that we may see how these conquests can be at all or wholly possible, we must find out the reality of matter, just as, seeking the fundamental knowledge, we have found out the reality of mind and soul and life. So he insists on a solid and integrated victory of spirit in its instruments. This alone can satisfy the indwelling present of Satchit Ananda in all this. The free and perfect occupation. And we can see that this individual, this consummation of the awakening soul, governing and impressing its own implied perfection upon all this nature, makes all the others really possible. It is in us that this spiritual victory becomes complete. Pardon me. In a certain sense, matter is unreal and non-existent. That is to say, our present knowledge, idea, and experience of matter is not its truth, but merely a phenomenon of particular relation between our senses and the all existence in which we move. In other words, we don't know it really through what we gather via our senses and what we compose about it in our envisioning mind. When science discovers that matter resolves itself into forms of energy. Originally here, he wrote force. It has hold of a universal and fundamental truth. And when philosophy discovers that matter only exists as substantial appearance to the consciousness, and that the one reality is spirit or pure conscious being, it has hold of a greater and completer, a still more fundamental truth. So, the first science discovering the nature of matter, or attempting to, would be physics. When Einstein's theories become well known, then when Sri Aurobindo recomposes the life divine, he alters the term force to be energy, which is more compliant with Einstein's view of the nature of the physical universe. And then, in perspective of philosophy, this is a stance typical to idealism and its many branches, that we do not see the world as it is, and the world as it is a presentation to our consciousness. Might be, indeed, that the world appears to us as real because our consciousness sees it. In other words, it is awareness that makes matter real, a reversal of the physicalist's perspective that we gain access to what is real when we look at matter. It is the entire reversal. So Einstein and Berkeley in one paragraph here. But still the question remains why energy, originally force, should take the form of matter and not of mere force currents, or why that which is really spirit should admit the phenomenon of matter and not rest in states, velleities, and joys of the spirit. Why should this occur? By the way, velleity is a word from the Latin velle, to wish, which is a low or weak form of volition, a mere inclination. Gee, I wish I could get that glass of water which is only 3 feet from me. Oh, but I won't bother to stand up. That is a velleity. This, it is said, is the work of mind, or else, since evidently thought does not directly create or even perceive the material form of things, it is the work of sense. The sense mind creates the forms which it seems to perceive, and the thought mind works upon the forms which the sense mind presents to it. So this, again, is something that even in modern philosophy, with, you could even say with Berkeley, and certainly with John Locke, you cannot get to the thing in itself, may as well include Kant, because what we are perceiving and thinking about is a gathering brought to us by our senses. The senses reach out and grab this stuff, report back to brain central, to the mind, and the mind composes a thought about it. But never do we touch that piece of matter directly. This is all by indirection. And if we were going to go back to ancient Indian philosophy, again, the sense action would be the action of the manas. The organizational power would be the action of the buddhi. And again, we're watching the procession of reality from the subtle to the gross, because the mind projects the senses, and the senses project the objects of the senses. So in some sense, we're always looking, in a sense, down towards matter, not grasping it utterly, because really the seed of its existence is in consciousness. Ah, we'll get back to that in a moment. When we look at it from the perspective of Satchit-Ananda and not from the perspective of Sankhya. Whenever we begin dealing with this language, though, of philosophy, we always wind up with this dualistic terminology, which tends to divide and separate things which are ultimately one. It's a reflection of the condition of the mind. And it is the mind that we have to outgrow, is it not, to establish unity in life, unity in consciousness. Back to Sri Aurobindo. But evidently, the individual embodied mind is not the creator of the phenomenon of matter. Earth existence cannot be the result of the human mind, which is itself the result of earth existence. If we say that the world exists only in our own minds, we express a non-fact and a confusion, for the material world existed before man was upon the earth, and it will go on existing if man disappears from the earth, or even if our individual mind abolishes itself in the infinite. So there is a cosmological precedence here. And this applies even if we were looking at this from the perspective of Advaita Vedanta. We must conclude then that there is a universal mind, subconscious to us in the form of the universe, or superconscious in its spirit, which has created that form for its habitation. So if we're going to derive, in other words, the world from a mind, it must be from a universal mind. Perhaps we cannot arrive at that because it exists, fashioned as the universe, in the subconscious. We cannot get at it. Or we can find it equally in the superconscious, that universal mind there, or that universal mind here in the form of the cosmos as matter. If mind creates, it has to be from a universal station. You see, that's the key point. It cannot be from an individual. We cannot say that it all is in our mind, because minds are many and the universe is wide. And since the Creator must have preceded, he writes, and must exceed its creation, this really implies a superconscient mind, which by the instrumentality of a universal sense creates in itself the relation of form with form, and constitutes the rhythm of the material universe. So it must be that there is a superconscient mind, a kind of overmind, as he says in the note below. Let's read that note. Mind, as we know it, creates only in a relative and instrumental sense. It has an unlimited power of combination, but its creative motives and forms come to it from above. All created forms have their base in the infinite above mind, life, and matter, and are here represented, reconstructed, very usually misconstructed, from the infinitesimal. Their foundation is above, their branches downward, says the Rig Veda. The superconscient mind of which we speak might rather be called an overmind, and inhabits in the hierarchical order of the powers of the spirit a zone directly dependent on the supramental consciousness. So he posits a vast awareness, mental in character, because giving strong emphasis to the diversity, but distributive in its power. This would be the overmind between the station of supermind above and the mind as we know it in terms of its higher ratiocination. So it would be the overmind which would be functioning as a cosmic principle of creation, not mind itself.
(Clears
We have a little more time. I'd like to do another paragraph, if you're willing to bear with me. Let's finish this last paragraph. But this also is no complete solution. It tells us that matter is a creation of consciousness, but it does not explain how consciousness came to create matter as the basis of its cosmic workings. And now he goes back to his ontology as expressed earlier. We shall understand better if we go back at once to the original principle of things. Existence is in its activity a conscious force which presents the workings of its force to its consciousness as forms of its own being. So this is a reference clearly to Satchitananda. Sat, existence, chit, consciousness, but also consciousness power, and ananda, bliss, delight, the nature of this self-existent and all-aware being. So existence is consciousness force. Since force is only the action of one sole existing conscious being, its results can be nothing else but forms of that conscious being. In other words, if it acts, everything that comes out of it must be an expression of true being. Substance or matter, then, is only a form of spirit, necessarily, because the only thing that exists is Satchitananda. So matter is spirit. The appearance which this form of spirit assumes to our senses is due to that dividing action of mind from which we have been able to deduce consistently the whole phenomenon of the universe. So if you remember, Satchitananda constellates itself as a supramental consciousness which brings the infinite into harmonic expression within itself. And as the supramental permits diversity to live in complete balanced unity with its own true nature, oneness and diversity and harmony, it permits the diversity to move forward from its unity and gain expression through the principle of the mind, which he has described here. The appearance which this form of spirit assumes to our senses is due to that dividing action of mind from which we have been able to deduce consistently the whole phenomenon of the universe. So again, this is how it gets here. The unity made diverse, and then diversity distributed through the mind. We know now that life is an action of conscious force of which material forms are the result. Let's pause there. So, if from that great quaternary of being, Sat Chit Ananda expressed as supermind, so Sat Chit Ananda 3, supermind 4, supermind presents itself as mind. Life presents itself as conscious force, Chit Tapas, of which material forms are the result. Life involved in those forms, appearing in them first as inconscient force, evolves and brings back into manifestation as mind the consciousness which is the real self of the force and which never ceased to exist in it even when unmanifest. So life involves material form. It is the power by which material forms come into being. And let's remember that life here is not simply the living force in living creatures. It is the power of energy expressive in the whole cosmos from the inconscient up. But life serves this function and takes that which mind issues forth with and empowers it and stations it, installs it in the materiality of forms. Even so, consciousness, even when it seems to be inconscient at the basis of this material foundation, is really still there. And then the evolving power of life force, it evolves and then it evolves. As it begins to evolve, it brings forth this power of consciousness, which emerges not simply in the principle of living things again, but begins to flower out in mind. So life takes the embedded consciousness and expresses it as mind. But this awareness was always present. It was never absent. It was simply submerged. So we know also, he writes, that mind is an inferior power of the original conscious knowledge or supermind, a power to which life acts as an instrumental energy. For descending through supermind, consciousness or chit represents itself as mind. Force of consciousness or tapas represents itself as life. Mind, by its separation from its own higher reality and supermind, gives life the appearance of division, and by its farther involution in its own life force, becomes subconscious in life, and thus gives the outward appearance of an inconscient force to its material workings. So as an instrument, life dynamizes mind, which itself proceeds from supermind. But life is darkened and divided by mind's separative character as it moves into the universal expression. Therefore, he says, the inconscience, the inertia, the atomic disaggregation of matter must have their source in this all-dividing and self-involving action of mind by which our universe came into being. In other words, it's all the mind's fault. As mind is only a final action of supermind in the descent towards creation and life, an action of conscious force working in the conditions of the ignorance created by this descent of mind, so matter, as we know it, is only the final form taken by conscious being as the result of that working. So this, too, is conscious being. Chit Shakti expressing Sat. Matter veils real, true being. It is Sat. Matter, he says, is substance of the one conscious being, phenomenally divided within itself by the action of a universal mind, a division which the individual mind repeats and dwells in, but which does not abrogate or at all diminish the unity of spirit or the unity of energy or the real unity of matter. In other words, this is a cosmic function. Yes, we who possess a mind here individually cannot claim responsibility for the imperfection of the universe at this junction of its development, but we participate in that imperfection. Matter is an imperfect precipitate, you see, of the dividing nature of mind. If matter could come into being directly from the supramental without installing itself in these other stages of ontological reality, full diversity would never have been given its chance. In a way, the apparent imperfection of the cosmos permits us to work from ultimate disaggregation, from apparent disintegration, and in achieving reunification with Satchit-Ananda, claiming our heritage is a greater victory by going through this darkness and division than by simply owning it from the beginning. There is a footnote below. I think we should read that. When he's talking about universal mind, mind is here used in its widest sense, including the operation of an overmind power, which is nearest to the supramental truth consciousness, and which is the first fountain of the creation of the ignorance. So now we can see that there is a scale of existence which is clearly marked out. Satchit-Ananda, a linking, creative, harmonic world of the supramental, and then a descent through the dividing apparatus of mind into mind proper, life, and matter. Between supermind and mind stands this overmental consciousness, which is vast, which is cosmic, more than cosmic, expressing the totalizing power of the supermind, giving full voice to the diversity and the perspectivity of each truth as it emerges from the supermind. And it is from that extreme freedom given to the diversity that we lapse into the apparent division of mind, life, and body, encasement after encasement, implanement after implanement, until we arrive at what seems to be what is disintegrated, what is inconscient, what is darkness itself, a kind of chaos. Can we, to borrow from the Greek, move from chaos back to cosmos? Cosmos is the ordered reality of things. Can we create that in terms that are satisfying to Satchit-Ananda, which originated all of this through its supramental self? That is the question. And we have been sent here, missioned as souls, to take up that very adventure. The question is cosmic. It is not whether we want to do it for ourselves. Do we want to liberate ourselves and regain unity with what is supreme? It isn't about saving ourselves. It is the whole of the universe which is at stake. So Sri Aurobindo's has been correctly called a cosmic yoga. Sri Aurobindo, by the way, was born on the 15th of August, which we celebrate next week, and we'll bring to conclusion this first chapter. Let me rephrase that. We will bring to conclusion this 24th chapter on matter next week and say a few words about Sri Aurobindo and the fullness and power of his life. So thank you for bearing with us tonight. I salute what is divine in you. Namaste.
Namaste.
Jai Ma.
Jai Ma.